Welcome to Operation Restore Christian America, ladies and gentlemen. My name is David Stovenel.
He can see us whatever we do. Whatever we do, he has such powerful eyes. He doesn't have millions and thousands and billions. And he can still see us when we're bad.
He could be sitting on the table right now, but you can't see him.
He can't be everywhere at once doing everything for everybody. Everybody can't get what they want.
Welcome to Operation Restore Christian America, ladies and gentlemen. My name is David Stovenel. It's the 17th of July, 2023. And welcome to the broadcast, all of those of you that are listening over the radio and over the internet. Today is part four of John Quincy Adams' Letters on Freemasonry. Just a couple of quotes and then a Bible reading before we move on to one of the letters. We're going to dig into one of the letters that John Quincy Adams wrote early on after he discovered the murder of a Freemason. And so anyway, this was something that Thomas Jefferson wrote. And I want you to think of Joe Biden when you hear this quotation, because we know he's been there for more than 40 years within politics. Whenever a man has cast a longing eye on offices, a rottenness begins in his conduct. And then a quote from Friedrich Nietzsche, a German philosopher from the 19th century. Insanity in individuals is something rare, but in groups, parties, nations, and epochs, it is the rule. I hope you take those to mind, because those are very important quotes in terms of the times we are living in how extreme some politicians misbehave. And I think the word misbehave is even too light of a word to use, but I try to keep a decorum here that is suitable for children as well as for men and women. I'm going to the first epistle of John, chapter 3, and I'm going to read verses 1 through 4 for the context of what we'll be talking about today, which is about Freemasons that murdered another Freemason. Once again, 1 John chapter 3, beginning at verse 1. Behold, what manner of love the Father hath bestowed upon us, that we should be called the sons of God. Therefore, the world knoweth us not, because it knew him not. Beloved, now are we the sons of God, and it doth not yet appear what we shall be, but we know that when he shall appear, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. And every man that hath this hope in him purifieth himself, even as he is pure. Whosoever committeth sin transgresseth also the law, for sin is the transgression of the law. And that's the verses that I'm reading for today to set the table for digging more deeply into John Quincy Adams' Letters on Freemasonry. And before going to the first letter, this bears repeating, and there are new listeners every week. So it's important to reiterate something that is so important as to what Freemasonry really is, because right now there are a lot more Freemasons that are in powerful political positions, in powerful business positions, and in private life in businesses than there ever have been, partly as the result of the population of the world is larger than ever before. But anyway, this particular description here is where I'll begin. Strange though it, and this is after John Quincy Adams discovered and heard about this horrific torture and murder of Captain William Morgan. Strange though it may seem, it is nevertheless equally certain that the most revolting features of the obligation, the pledges, subversive of all moral distinctions, and the penalties for violating those pledges, were not those things which roused the most general popular disapprobation. Here, as often before, the shield of private character, that's a polite way of saying occult, earned by a life of conversation without reproach, was interposed with effect to screen from censure men who protested that when they swore to keep the secret the crimes which their brethren might have committed, provided they were revealed to them under the Masonic sign, they did nothing which they deemed inconsistent with their duties as Christians and as members of society. It is the tendency of mankind to mix with all abstract reasoning, however pure and perfect, a great deal of the alloy of human authority to harden its nature. Multitudes preferred to believe the Masonic oaths and penalties to be ceremonies, childish, ridiculous, and unmeaning, rather than to suppose them intrinsically and incurably vicious. Now, there you have something that is in the preface of the book, Letters on Freemasonry, that the title of it is John Quincy Adams, Letters on Freemasonry. And this book, incidentally, once again, and I have said this before, but as I say, it bears repeating, because each and every one of you that are hearing this, and I have no financial interest in this. I'm just saying this because I hope that you can hear me well enough to buy this from the ministry that's carried on over in Texas, that Tex Mars, he collated and assembled this and produced this reprint of this book. So I hope each and every one of you get a copy of this and study this so you can understand the intrinsic evil of Freemasonry, because the sovereign of Freemasonry is the sovereign of Great Britain. And that's another subject for it's the same subject for another day of how I'll describe how King Charles Windsor is the sovereign, the earthly flesh and blood sovereign that worships Lucifer, that is the sovereign of flesh and blood earthly Freemasonry. So anyway, I hope you'll order a copy of John Quincy Adams' Letters on Freemasonry, because, well, for one thing, we can all improve our language, because we are in a fallen state now, if there ever has been. It seems that even the highest paid employees, even our highest paid employees in the government, even the President of the United States, uses language and does things that are reprehensible. And so obviously there was a time when there was more dignity within that office and within our society as general, as that office holds a man that is supposed to be showing leadership for that which is good and right and just. Anyway, one of the letters that I'm going to read. These are very brief letters. These are essentially brief exchanges so that he can come to a knowledge of exactly what Freemasonry is, as when the news of Captain William Morgan broke of his torture and murder, this investigation was very thorough. But anyway, this is a letter to a reviewer of Shepherd's defense of the Masonic institution. And here's what the Boston Press wrote. The following letter from John Quincy Adams explains the views of his illustrious father and of himself on the subject of Freemasonry. It was written in reply to a note from our correspondent who is reviewing Mr. Shepherd's defense of the Masonic institution. It may be recollected that Mr. Shepherd claimed the Elder Adams as a patron of the order, and our correspondent took the liberty of addressing Mr. Adams asking for information on this point. And once again, that was in the Boston Press. Here's John Quincy Adams' letter, and this is dated 22 August, 1831. Sir, the letter from my father to the Grand Lodge of Massachusetts, which Mr. Shepherd has thought proper to introduce into his address, was a complimentary letter to a friendly and patriotic address of the Grand Lodge to him. In it, he expressly states that he had never been initiated in the order. He therefore knew nothing of their secrets, their oaths, nor their penalties. Far less had their practical operation been revealed by the murder of William Morgan, nor had the hand of the Avenger of Blood been arrested for 5 long years, and probably forever, by the contumacy of witnesses setting justice at defiance in her own sanctuary. Nor had the trial of an accomplice in guilt marked the influence of one juror under Masonic oaths upon the verdict of his 11 fellows. That Mr. Shepherd should resort to a letter from my father, a professedly uninitiated man, to liberate the Masonic institution from the unrefuted charge of unlawful oaths, of horrible and disgusting penalties and secrets, the divulging of which has been punished by the murder unsurpassed in human atrocity, is to me passing strange. All that my father knew of Masonry in 1798 was that it was favorable to the support of civil authority, and this he inferred from the characters of intimate friends of his and excellent men who had been members of the society. The inference was surely natural, but he had never seen the civil authority in conflict with Masonry itself. To speak of the Masonic institution as favorable to the support of civil authority at this day and in this country would be a mockery of the common sense and sensibility of mankind. My father says he had known the love of the fine arts, the delight in hospitality, and the devotion to humanity of the Masonic fraternity. All these qualities, no doubt, then, were as yet are conspicuous in many members of the society. They, and qualities of a yet higher order, were not less conspicuous in the order of the Jesuits. They were conspicuous in many of the monastic orders in the Inquisition itself, whose ministers, in the very act of burning the body of the heretic to death, were always actuated by the tenderest and most humane regard for the salvation of his soul. The use of my father's name for the purposes to which Mr. Shepherd would now apply it is an injury to his memory, which I deem it my duty, as far as may be in my power, to redress. You observe, he says he had never been initiated in the Masonic order, and I have more than once heard from his own lips why he had never enjoyed that felicity. Mr. Jeremy Gridley, whom he mentions as having been his intimate friend, was Grand Master of the Massachusetts Grand Lodge. He was also the Attorney General of the Crown. When in October 1758, my father, having finished his law studies and his schoolkeeping at Worcester, presented himself, a stranger, poor, friendless, and obscure, to ask of him the favor to present him to the Superior Court of the province, then sitting at Boston, for admission to the bar. Mr. Gridley, in his own office, examined the youthful aspirant with regard to his professional acquirements, gave him advice truly paternal and dictated by the purest virtue, and then presented him to the court with a declaration that he had himself examined him and could assure their honors that his legal acquirements were very considerable and fully worthy of his admission, which he solicited. This kindness of Mr. Gridley was never forgotten by my father. I trust it will never be forgotten by his children. From that day forth, while Mr. Gridley lived, he was the intimate friend, personal and professional, of my father. He died in 1767. My father often resorted to him for friendly counsel, and as he was Grand Master of the Lodge, once asked his advice, whether it was worth his while to become a member of the society. In the candor of friendship, Mr. Gridley answered him, no, adding that by aggregation to the society a young man might acquire a little artificial support, but that he did not need it, and that there was nothing in the Masonic institution worthy of his seeking to be associated with it. So said, at that time, the Grand Master of the Massachusetts Masons, Jeremy Gridley. And such, I have repeatedly heard my father say, was the reason why he never joined the lodge. The use of the name of Washington to give an odor of sanctity to the institution as it now stands exposed to the world is, in my opinion, as unwarrantable as that of my father's name. On the mortal side of human existence, there is no name for which I entertain a veneration more profound than for that of Washington. But he was never called to consider the Masonic order in the light in which it must now be viewed. If he had been, we have a pledge of what his conduct would have been, far more authoritative than the mere fact of his having been a Mason can be in favor of the Brotherhood. If you wish to know what that pledge is, please to consult the recently published writings of Thomas Jefferson, Volume 1, from page 416 to 422, and especially the paragraph beginning at the middle of page 418. I would earnestly recommend the perusal and meditation of the whole passage to all virtuous and conscientious Masons, of whom I know there are great numbers. If they wish to draw precepts for their own conduct from the example and principles of Washington, or from the deliberate and anxious opinions and solicitude of Jefferson, they will find in those pages lessons of duty for themselves, which they might consider it as presumption in me to offer them. The application of the principles, in a case not identically the same, but in every essential point of argument similar, and in many respects from a weaker to a much stronger basis, I would leave to their own discretion, though first divested of its passions. It is, in my opinion, an unanswerable demonstration of the duty of every Mason in the United States at this day. I never heard and do not believe that the Reverend Dr. Bentley ever delivered or published a sermon in censuring my father for anything he had ever said upon the subject of Masonry. The electoral vote of Massachusetts in 1801 was unanimous for my father. You are at liberty to make what use of this letter you please, giving notice, if you publish it, that it is in answer to a letter of inquiry received by me. I am, very respectfully, sir, your obedient servant, John Quincy Adams. That, ladies and gentlemen, is a response to a very important letter that had an allegation in it that had a that carried a falsehood. And the President of the United States at that time responded without using any language that would be called profane or even overly hyperbolic. If we could just recapture this, even to some degree, in our world today, we would be much better off, because it seems that we're throwing away American English and embracing the nastiest word that was ever conceived, that is British English. And of course, I'm referring to an acronym, the F word. It seems that even politicians cannot refrain from the disgusting use of that word. And so, if I can convince or encourage anyone to clean up their act, then you're doing your part to restore this great nation to its rightful place among nations, which is as one of the several Christian nations. And if you'll remember, the man that was president, but it was very questionable of whether he was even born within one of the United States, a man named Barack Obama, declared that America was no longer a Christian nation. And he was held up as a great constitutional scholar. And I have often wondered if he had ever been taught or discovered the 1892 U.S. versus Church of the Holy Trinity opinion, that was a unanimous opinion that's never been overturned, that declares America culturally a Christian nation. I'm going to move on to the second letter, because I'm just so, compelled to want to encourage others to buy themselves a copy of this book. Incidentally, it can be read online. You can find it online, but it's just harder on the eyes than the printed word. And the printed word will obviously be at your disposal no matter what else happens. Anyway, the second letter is to Edward Ingersoll, Esquire, meaning he's a lawyer, in Philadelphia, September 21st, 1831. Mr. Chandler has truly informed me that I am a zealous anti-Mason to this extent. It is my deliberate opinion that from the time of the commission of the crimes committed at the kidnapping and murder of William Morgan, it became the solemn and sacred civic and social duty of every Masonic lodge in the United States either to dissolve itself or to discard forever all administration of oaths and penalties and all injunctions of secrecy of any kind of its to its members. I believed it also their duty, though of less imperious obligation, to abolish all their ill-assorted, horrific titles and childish or ridiculous pageants. I believed it is also a duty sacredly incumbent upon every individual Freemason in the United States to use all the influence in his power to prevail upon his brethren of the order to the same end, that is, to the total abolition of the order or to its discarding forever all oaths, all penalties, all secrets, and all fantastic titles, exhibitions, and ceremonies heretofore used in the institution. Believing these to be their duties, I did not feel myself called to take an active part in the controversy which I saw arising in the community concerning them. I took considerable pains to avoid entering into that controversy. I endured from individuals of the fraternity, instigated by the passions of the order, falsehood, by statements in their newspapers that I was one of their members, perjury to affect the presidential election, by an affidavit sworn to before a Masonic magistrate by a Master Mason that he had sat with me twice at meetings of a lodge at Pittsfield, insulting, cajoling, threatening, anonymous letters from Masonic sources, abusive slander and vituperation in Masonic newspapers, pamphlets, and even volumes, and other wrongs of which it behooves me not to speak. All these I have endured for a space now of at least 4 years without reply, without complaint, never disguising in the conversations of social intercourse the opinions above expressed, never seeking occasion to promulge them, and declining time after time on many occasions and in various forms to engage in the turmoil of Masonic and anti-Masonic warfare. At last, an English shepherd of Masonic sheep at Wiscasset in Maine has the impudence to vouch in my father as a witness to the sublime and transcendent virtues of Masonry, and in the same pamphlet casts a due portion of his Masonic filth at me. For what? Because in a confidential letter not intended for the public and published without my consent, I had once written that I should never be a Mason, and because I had twice, by special invitations, been present as a mere spectator at meetings of anti-Masons in Boston, still I should have overlooked Mr. Shepherd and his Masonic virtues with the rest, but that the editor of the Boston Press, undertaking to review his defense of Masonry, wrote to me to inquire what I knew of this pretended panegyric upon Masonry by my father. I then wrote the letter, which you have seen, and which the friendly commentary of Mr. Walsh, to whom you may, if you please, with my compliments, show this letter, attributes to the error of the moon. Quote, error of the moon, end of quote. I said the crimes committed at the kidnapping and murder of William Morgan. Do you know what they were? Were they not, number one, fraudulent abuse in repeated forms of the process of the law to obtain upon false pretenses possession of the person of Morgan? Number two, infamous slander in those false pretenses by first arresting him on a charge against him of petty larceny. Number three, previous slander in newspaper advertisements denouncing him as a swindler and impostor, calling upon brethren and companions particularly to observe, mark, and govern themselves accordingly, and declaring that the fraternity had amply provided against his evil design. Number four, conspiracy of Masonic lodges assembled in great numbers, per fas et nefas, by the commission of any crime to suppress his book. Number five, arson by setting fire at night to Miller's printing office, in which building were 8 or 10 persons asleep, whose lives were saved only by the early discovery of the projected conflagration. Number six, fraud, deception, and treachery in procuring from Morgan himself a part of his manuscript, which was finally sent by a special messenger to the General Grand Chapter of the United States in session at New York. 7. Kidnapping, too successfully practiced upon Morgan, attempted upon Miller. 8. False imprisonment and transportation of Morgan beyond the bounds of the United States into a foreign territory. Number 9, a murder taking 9 days in its perpetration, keeping the wretched and helpless victim throughout the whole of that time in a state of continual and cruel torture. And I repeat, number 9, what Freemasons perpetrated on another Freemason. Number 9, a murder taking 9 days in its perpetration, keeping the wretched and helpless victim throughout the whole of that time in a state of continual and cruel torture. Sleep upon this list of peccadilloes, and tomorrow I will give you upon them a word of comment. Yours, John Quincy Adams. Well, that's the second letter on Freemasonry in the book that you can order that from the ministry that Jerry Barrett is carrying on down in Texas. If you word search Jerry Barrett or Tex Mars Letters on Freemasonry or John Quincy Adams Letters on Freemasonry, you'll obviously be able to order and get a copy of this and secure this to yourself so you can study it with Freemasons, with friends that are not Freemasons, with pastors, with people in political office, with people in business, to bring this darkness to the light so that Freemasons that are active today can escape from that evil, darkness, death. Incidentally, it was five Freemasons on the Warren Court, on the Earl Warren Court, who was a Supreme Court justice from California during the Johnson administration primarily. And five Freemasons on that court removed prayer and the Bible from public schools in the United States of America. Obviously, blatant hypocrisy and an absolute repugnance here in our Christian nation. A repugnance that is so enormous you have to call it criminal activity. It's criminal activity from the bench. Furthermore, there is a lot said about Jews being responsible for all of the evils of the world. And yes, there are Jews that are Satanists, that murder people, but they are certainly not the only people that do that. But Jews are getting a rather large amount of opprobrium as the result of a lot of things that are going bad and going wrong now. Some of it they richly deserve, the ones that are wicked. But anyway, speaking of Hollywood and how it was established originally, it was five Jews that were the owners of the five major production companies during the early years of Hollywood, back in the 1920s to 1930s and beyond. They were also all five Freemasons. So there's a connection there. So who do you blame? Do you blame the English Freemasons, the British king all by himself? No. You see, these are his lieutenants in this war against Christ and his Christians. At its essence, that's what they're after. They're on a mission to destroy all that is good in the world so they can have complete world domination. Now, for the third letter that is in this extraordinary expose of what Freemasonry really was and now is, only now is much worse. To Edward Ingersoll, Esquire. Quincy, September 22nd, 1831. Dear Sir, I gave you in my last letter a list of nine crimes among the most atrocious that can be perpetrated by human agency committed in the original transactions connected with what has been, by an exceedingly inappropriate euphony, called the abduction and murder of William Morgan. Abduction is a word of lamb-like innocence compared with the ingredients of wickedness which compose the crime of his taking off. Language sinks under the effort to express its complicated malignity. These crimes, I allege, were committed by the fraternity. They were instigated by no impulse of individual passions, by none of the stimulants to the ordinary outrages of man upon man, by no personal animosity, by no purpose of robbery. They were the crimes of the craft, of which the guilty agents by whom they were consummated were but the fanatical instruments. And here I pray you to remark that I have stated these crimes interrogatively. I have inquired of you whether they were not the crimes committed in those transactions, to the end that if you find upon inquiry that I have set them down incorrectly or with exaggeration, you may reduce them in number or in virulence to their just and well-proportioned standard. I charge them upon the craft as the means by which public notice had been given beforehand that the fraternity had amply provided against his design. In these crimes, several hundreds of persons appear to have participated as principals or accessories before or after the fact. The measures were taken not individually, but as result of corporate deliberation in sundry lodges. Mr. Minor, one of the most amiable and benevolent of men, has mistaken the terms of the anti-Masonic proposition. There are no doubt degrees of exasperation of different temperature among the anti-Masons, but I know of none disposed to hold every individual Mason responsible for the tragedy of Morgan's murder. All know that there are now, as there always have been, Masons among the most respectable and virtuous members of the community. But they belong to a vicious institution, and it is their duty to withdraw from that institution, to abolish it, or to purify it from its vices, oaths, penalties, and secrets. That the institution is vicious might be very conclusively inferred from the effects disclosed in the 9 crimes above enumerated, even if their causes were yet secret. But those causes have been divulged. We know that every entered apprentice of Masonry has, hoodwinked and with a halter round his neck, administered to him an oath, the words of which he is required to repeat with his lips, never to divulge the secrets of the order, and binding himself by, quote, no less a penalty than to have his throat cut across, his tongue torn out by the roots, and his body buried in the rough sands of the sea at low water mark, where the tide ebbs and flows twice in 24 hours. End of quote. Morgan divulged these secrets, and his fate is the practical commentary upon the penalty. The oath, the penalty, the secret, and Morgan's corpse at the bottom of Niagara River, where a shrewd brother of the craft, quote, guessed he would publish no more books, end of quote, are illustrations of each other which it would take much sophistry to obscure, much prevarication to confuse. Mr. Minor has taken this oath and bound himself by no less than this penalty. It is wise and prudent in him, therefore, not to violate the oath, and he would assuredly not have been the man to execute the penalty upon Morgan for considering it a dead letter. But will Mr. Minor tell you that the penalty is, or that it is not, a dead letter? If it is, surely the oath is the same, and then it is mere profanity, a taking of the name of God in vain, odious in proportion to the disgusting solemnity of the form in which it is administered. If it is not a dead letter, what is it? Some of the Masonic defenses allege that it is only an imprecation. Quote, under no less a penalty than to have my throat cut, end of quote, a mere imprecation? Is it not then a paltering with words and double senses? A penalty is not an imprecation, and to have the throat cut across and the tongue torn out by the roots is not expulsion from a lodge. The substance of the defense is that the penalty is a brutum fulmen, that there is no authority existing in or conferred by the institution to carry it into execution, and that it is a special charge to all Masons upon their admission to observe faithfully the laws of God and the land. But for every degree of Masonry, there is a separate oath and a diversified penalty, and in some of the higher degrees, it includes a promise to carry into effect the punishments of the fraternity. I have heard of the instructions from the owner of the piratical cruiser to his captain, directing him to take, burn, sink, or destroy any merchant vessel of any nation that might fall in his way, and to dispose of the people on board of them so as that they might not prove afterwards troublesome. But to be specially careful not to infringe upon the laws of nations or of humanity. This man must have been a Mason of at least the Royal Arch degree, that the oaths and penalties of Masonry were not understood by the multitudes of Masons accessory to the commission of the 9 crimes enumerated in my list as mere imprecations is self-evident. By them, they were understood, according to their plain, unambiguous import, as an absolute, unequivocal forfeiture of life and an explicit consent of the person taking the oath that he should be put to death in the horrid manner described in the terms of the penalty if he should divulge the secrets of the order. But whether the penalty be, as it purports, a real penalty or a mere imprecation, will Mr. Minor say that it is a form of words and obligations fit to be administered with a solemn invocation of the name of God to a Christian and a free man? Cruel and unusual punishments are equally abhorrent to the mild spirit of Christianity and to the spirit of equal liberty. The infliction of them is expressly prohibited in the Bill of Rights of this Commonwealth, and yet thousands of her citizens have attested the name of God to subject themselves to death by tortures which cannibal savages would instinctively shrink from inflicting. It has, therefore, been, in my opinion, ever since the disclosure of the Morgan murder crimes and of the Masonic oaths and penalties by which they were instigated, the indispensable duty of the Masonic Order of the United States either to dissolve itself or to discard forever from its constitution and laws all oaths, all penalties, all secrets, and as ridiculous appendages to them, all mysteries and pageants. Believing this to be the duty of the whole order, I have deemed it a duty equally indispensable of every individual Mason to use in calmness and moderation all his influence with the fraternity to come to one or the other of these results. And I have, since the New York elections of the last autumn, deemed this to be a duty especially and above all incumbent upon Mr. Clay. I mean that he should have set a similar example to that of Washington in endeavoring to prevail upon the order of the Cincinnati to dissolve themselves, or at least to discard the most exceptional parts of their constitution, in which latter purpose he succeeded. I have not said this to Mr. Clay, because in the estimate of his duties, he must be his own counselor, and I know he has had advice from another quarter, which he has doubtless deliberately weighed. But it brings me to a point upon which I shall ask a few minutes further of your patience for your friend hereafter, John Quincy Adams. And that's the finish of that next letter to Mr. Ingersoll. Now, to make another comment about Freemasons and Freemasonry. Well, first of all, I want to say a couple of things about myself. As a genuine Christian, I'm not a National Socialist. I'm not a Nazi. I'm not a Black Lives Matter. I'm not an Antifa. I'm none of those things. As a genuine Christian, I speak the truth, I read from the scriptures, and I find material that is pertinent to our day that will lend to a restoration. And I need an entire army of genuine Christians that will read the King James Bible so we all can come with one accord. Because if you read all of the spurious versions of the Bible, you will just get in arguments by thinking that you have finally found a higher truth that's in the King James Bible, because that's exactly what Westcott and Hort, two socialists, intended. And additionally, I'm not a communist or a Nazi or a socialist or any of that. As a genuine Christian, that's a separate entity. That's a born-again man that is no longer the old man, the American. I'm an America seconder now. I'm a Christian first. I'm in Christ's family. I'm adopted into God's holy family. And I just beg each and every one of you, study the New Testament. Read the four Gospels and see what the truth is about what actually happened and the miracles of Christ's resurrection from the dead, his crucifixion and his resurrection from the dead, and his leaving us with the Comforter, the Lord Holy Ghost, that prompts our spirit to be for truth and righteousness always. Anyway, I have often wondered what it was about my entire lifetime that caused one of the political and military and spiritual leaders of this last century to have more opprobrium heaped on him than any other leader, Mad Bomber Harris isn't even mentioned compared to this other leader. And of course, I'm speaking of Adolf Hitler. And I'm not an Adolf Hitler apologist. I'm not a National Socialist apologist. I'm not a Nazi apologist. I'm a student of history and a genuine Christian that wants others to be excited about learning the truth about what happened in the past. Well, one of the things that happened in the past that I'm certain lends to the fact that so much opprobrium was heaped on Germany in general and Adolf Hitler in particular is that under Adolf Hitler's leadership, Germany banned Freemasonry from Germany. So that obviously would cause all of the occultists that survived the war and won the war over there in Windsor Castle and in Great Britain and in the United States and all over around the world, quite frankly, that would cause them to heap an extra measure of opprobrium on one man and on one country. And quite frankly, there were a lot of men and a lot of countries that were involved in World War II. And so there's a lot of opprobrium that deserves to be spread more evenly among all of the participants of that violent episode in history. Now, moving along to the next letter to Edward Ingersoll, Esquire. Of course, Edward Ingersoll was English. We have a very nice stone, brownstone house here in the little town I grew up in that's called the Ingersoll House. Anyway, to Edward Ingersoll, Esquire, Quincy, 23 September 1831. Dear sir, from the nature of the Masonic oaths, penalties, and secrets, and the construction given to them, not a forced and unnatural one, but comfortable to the plain import of their terms by multitudes of Masons in the western part of New York, the crimes immediately connected with the murder of William Morgan were committed. I charge them, therefore, upon the institution. And if Masonry had been, until then, a perfectly innocent and even useful institution, from the time of the commission of those crimes, it would have ceased to be so. From that time, the community acquired the right of calling upon the fraternity to discontinue and renounce, at least, the administration of oaths, the imposition of all forms of penalties, and all secrets. Whatever. A large and increasing portion of the community have made this demand, a demand just and reasonable in itself, and the more so as the oaths, penalties, and secrets have been divulged not only by Morgan's book, but by the concurring testimony of numerous seceding Masons. The oaths, the penalties, and the secrets, whether all disclosed with perfect accuracy or not, whether understood as they were by the murderers of Morgan or as explained by the defenders of Masonry, are unreasonable, odious, and I believe unlawful. The oaths of all Masons heretofore admitted, if they ever had any binding force, are dissolved by the fact of the public disclosure of the secrets which they had bound themselves to keep. Their country calls upon them to disclaim henceforth and forever all secrets, and all incidental to the injunction of them, all oaths and penalties. This reasonable and moderate call has not only been resisted by the great body of Freemasons throughout the United States, but no man, high or low, eminent or obscure, has dared to avow this opinion and unite in this call without being assailed in his reputation, robbed of his good name, insulted, abused, and vilified openly and in secret by individual Masons and by organized lodges, a body of at least 200,000 men scattered over the whole Union, all active and voting men linked together by secret ties for purposes of indefinite extent, bound together by oaths and penalties operating with terrific energy upon the imagination of the human heart and upon its fears. I'm stopping in this letter at that point in order to bring about a little bit of time. Next week, I'll be continuing with this letter to Mr. Ingersoll, and I'll also be talking about another law enforcement officer that was murdered, named Billy the Kid. Thank you for listening to the broadcast.